Blog Talk Radio.
Good to be back, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Been very, very busy working at the bookstore, Family Christian. We are in our final stages. There has been 49 bookstores slated to close earlier than May, and that is mine. Mine and Alton are going to be closing down very early. In fact, Wednesday, March 29th is my last day. It is really sad. I have loved that job for the last 10 and a half years, have had my book signings there, talked to my customers about Iran. It's been a real ministry. And I'm always encouraged that when God closes one door, he opens up another. And so I will be busy working there for the next couple of weeks, which limits me to only being here live once a week for right now. And that, of course, will change in about 2 or 3 weeks. But things have been crazy, and I'm just so happy to be here today live to bring you a broadcast. Please be in prayer for me as I do my best to think about where I need to work next and need another part-time job. It's going to be hard to find one quite as thrifty and resourceful as my bookstore job, but I will be looking, and I already have some ideas. But things are moving so fast, and we're going to be closing, gosh, in just a little over 2 weeks. And it's going to be sad to say goodbye to so many wonderful friends I've made over the last 10 years at the bookstore. Well, I have some very good news this morning for those of you that have been joining me in praying for Farzain Jalali, who was arrested about a month ago. It's been about a month ago in Kermanshah, Iran, for her human rights activities. Farzain, of course, a good friend of mine. I just received news this morning that she was released on bail, and she has been set free. Now, that doesn't mean everything is fine again. We need to really hold her up in prayer and continue to do this, because she's in great danger, because she's a very strong lady, and she speaks out for the truth of the freedom of Iranian people and the right to assemble and the right to protest and to do what she can to make life better for many Iranians. And when she does that, she runs square into the face of the dictatorship government. So please join me in continuing praying for Farzane. We're very grateful that she is out of jail there in Kermanshan, but she still needs our constant prayers. And I hope someday she can come back here to the United States and stay here, and she would be out of danger then for good. So continue to join me in prayer. I have the latest news posted about her up on my Facebook page. Today on The Cross in the Desert, I want to focus in on Iranian refugees. I have begun the work on my new book about my dear Iranian friend Maral. I want to talk about what's happening in Germany. That's where Maral lives. And about a year ago, CBN did a very special report about Iranian refugees in Germany and how they have come to Germany, most of them, to assimilate to a new culture of freedom, and most of them have become Christians. It's an incredible report. And what I want to do is I want to share that with you this morning. And then when we come back, I want to give you a sneak preview of the new book I'm writing about my dear Iranian friend Maral. Let's listen to this special report now on The Cross in the Desert.
Parts of Germany are among the most godless areas in the world. Polling shows that belief in God in the old East Germany is only 13%. But church attendance is growing here, thanks to former Muslims from Iran. At the House of God's Help in East Berlin, Persian converts to Christianity have doubled the size of the congregation. Deaconess Rosemary Gertz.
It came like an unexpected summer rain. Suddenly, new people started coming every week and asked to be baptized. In the beginning, only 5 or 6 Iranians came. They were easy to spot, and we got to know them. And then over time, they brought their friends and neighbors.
Germany has experienced a surge in Islam this year. Muslims conducted a nationwide campaign to give away Qurans in a country that has largely turned its back on biblical Christianity. But Iranian immigrants, or Persians, have already experienced the darkness and oppression of Islam in their native land, and they're hungry for the freedom and joy of Christianity. Michael asked that we disguise his face to protect his family in Iran.
I met a few times with friends in Tehran, in an underground church in a flat. And there we spoke about Jesus. And we tried to do a Bible study sometimes without an actual Bible.
All of the Persians we talked to accepted Christ in Iran and then had to either flee or risk prison or death.
I was on my way to a house church meeting when I saw police outside the flat. So I didn't go in. And later, I called my mother. She said, "The police were here looking for you." So my family helped me flee the country.
When I was in Iran, I wanted to become a Christian, but it's really difficult to learn about Christianity in Iran. It's forbidden for a Muslim to become a Christian. It was really difficult. I had to leave my parents, so I lost my home and my family.
Rosemary says the Persians were surprised to find so many Germans disinterested in Christianity.
Most of them became Christians in Iran and know more about Christianity than you would expect. They're ahead of us in a sense because they have already been persecuted for Christ. And they figured out pretty quickly that a lot of Germans are Christians in name only. And they're disappointed that Germans take religious freedom for granted.
Some Germans are suspicious of the conversions because being baptized can help a refugee stay in Germany rather than be deported. So Sister Rosemary takes the Persian converts through a rigorous schedule of Bible classes.
I did suspect that some of them just wanted to be baptized so they could get their residency in Germany. But that has turned out to be the case with only a few. In fact, some of them who've already been baptized have come back to our faith and baptism class for the fourth time.
It's not known how many Persian immigrants have converted and joined churches in Germany, but it has become a nationwide phenomenon and is numbering in the thousands. At the House of God's Help, it has reinvigorated the congregation. Dale Hurd, CBN News, Berlin.
An amazing story. The refugees, the Iranian refugees, are the passion and the love of my heart. And I do everything I can to write letters to the immigration board, to write stories about their escape from Iran. I do everything I can to bring awareness to you and to many others, the plight for freedom for Iranians. Can you imagine Iranians who have risked their lives to become Christians in Iran, and because the persecution is so heavy, they have to flee and find a safe place to worship? Can you imagine them risking their lives for Christ and then coming to Germany only to find there are fake and phony Christians in name only? And they have total religious freedom there. And the Iranians are saying, I don't understand. We almost lost our lives in Iran, and you have religious freedom, and you are ashamed to really stand up for Christ. It had to be a shock to many of these refugees who have truly become Christians. And later on in the broadcast today, we're going to be talking about salt and light, the teaching of Christ, of how we're to influence the culture. Really, the Iranian refugees are the light of the world in Germany because many, many of the German Christians are Christians in name only. And so my passion and joy is to be their voice. I have begun a new book called Finding Hope and a Future, Maral's Journey to Freedom. It's the story of my dear Iranian friend who lives in Germany, who became a Christian, and she is living her life for Christ. And I wanted to share her story. It's an incredible story as a refugee of the travels of her and her son Parham from Iran to Germany. What I thought I would do this morning with the time I have is just read to you from the new book that I have just begun writing. This is the preface. This will give you a good idea of what the book will be about. And let me read it to you. The joy and the passion of my life is being a voice, a hope, and freedom for my dear Iranian friends. For the past 6 years, since 2011, I have designated my Facebook page as a platform for human rights and posted petitions and articles speaking out for their justice. Besides posting petitions and articles, I have also written novels and biographies of my Iranian friends to awaken the world to their plight for freedom. I have met with them on Skype and Telegram, helping them with English, praying for them, and weeping with them. Within the last 2 years, I have met Iranians in several countries where they remain waiting for a long time for interviews with the immigration board. I have written letters for them, and on my radio program, The Cross in the Desert, I share with my listening audience their stories as refugees and the struggle they have in holding on to hope. 4 years ago, after the publication of my Iranian human rights novel, The Rose of Nowruz, Dreams of Hopes and Freedom, I met Maral. Maral lived in Shiraz, Iran, and was busy being a single parent, raising her young son named Parham. She met me on Skype and shared with me her battles with depression and the constant fear she had of living in Iran. Women in Iran struggle every day with suicide, depression, and fear because of living in a man-centered culture where Islam must be obeyed from birth until death. A woman must conform to the Islamic dress code and wear a hijab correctly whenever she goes out publicly. The morality police patrols the streets vigilantly, and if a woman is showing too much hair or skin, she can be fined, arrested, or publicly lashed. I had many wonderful Skype video chats with Maral. She would read my book on a PDF file, and I would help her with English. On one occasion, Maral shared with me her personal outrage against the government control of Iranian lives. It was such a powerful interview that I promised to write it as a blog and share it with my customers at my book signings. I will never forget the last Skype that I had with Maral in 2015. I remember she cried and begged me to pray for her. Her father-in-law had criticized her for not being a good Muslim mother or wife and had threatened to take her son away from her. Maral was desperate to take Parham out of Iran and start a new life. Time passed, and I didn't hear again from Maral. I was very concerned. Finally, one day in October, a few months later, I received a message from her sister, Farzane. Farzane explained that the police had come to Maral's home while she was at university. Fearing for her life, Maral's brother arranged for them to quickly disappear on Facebook or face certain arrest. For the next several months, I was updated by Farzane as she shared reports of Maral and Parham's travels with a refugee group across Turkey en route to Germany. The book you are about to read is that incredible journey that Maral and Parham embarked on over dangerous mountains, days without food, cold freezing nights, and clinging to life in a rubber raft on the Aegean Sea until they safely arrived in Germany. My desire in writing Maral's incredible story of survival is to put a real face on Iranian refugees so that the world will understand the pain, suffering, and despair that they experience every day in their quest for freedom and a new life. Come with me and let me take you into the world of an Iranian refugee. Come with me as I help you feel their fears and frustrations of living behind the Iron Curtain of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Come with me, and together let's weep with joy with them when they finally experience a new life of freedom and hope. This is Maral's story of finding hope and a future. It's the incredible story of a single mom who, against all odds, defied the government of Iran, trusted in God, and survived a very dangerous journey across the globe with her son to find hope and freedom once again. I am very excited about this novel. In fact, Maral had actually sent me a short few sentences, which I corrected in English. It's a dedication to her son, Parham. And in the book, on page 7, you'll see a picture of him, and you'll get to know him a little bit better. This is Maral's dedication to her son, Parham. My dear Parham, I thank God in giving you to me as the best gift in all of the world. You are my passion and motivation to be strong as a single mom ever since you were 2 years old. My desire for you, Parham, is to have a safe and happy future free from the fear and violence that we both experienced while living in Iran. I struggle with being a good mom, and I was worried that when you lost your dad, that I would never be able to take his place and raise you by myself. It is not easy, dear Parham, being both a father and mother to you. I will never forget how you encouraged me to keep fighting while on our dangerous journey together. You laid your head in my lap, trying to keep warm on freezing cold nights in the mountains when we were without food and sometimes without water. I held you in my arms when you cried and were afraid. But when I looked into your eyes, I was filled with hope again, because your eyes were full of life. I could see in your eyes the innocent look of a young man quickly growing up while we traveled day and night across dark and dangerous lands on our way to Germany. I was worried that you were too young and not strong enough to endure the harsh journey. But you amazed me, Parham. You survived. You grew up so fast during our journey together. Whenever I was afraid, you would give me a big hug, and immediately my fear melted away. I love you, my son, my dear Parham. There is no one in the world more precious to me than you. I pray that we will have a safe and prosperous future together now that we are both finally free. A dedication from Maral to her son Parham in the new book I am just starting to write, Finding Hope and a Future, Maral's Journey to Freedom. It's all about the Iranian refugees and the hope they find when they come to lands of freedom where they can worship Christ without fear and without persecution and death. I want to shift gears here just for a few minutes, and I want to make some comments on International Women's Day. Last week, my Facebook page was filled with pictures of Iranian political prisoners. I had pictures of Rahane, the book I wrote about the young Iranian lady that was executed because she defended herself against a government rapist. But of course, we had the radical left come out and do their little protest on a day without a woman. They left their jobs, right? And instead of working and being a great positive role model in the workplace, and they decided to quit their jobs for a day and go out on the streets and protest. And, of course, one of those individuals who led the protest was Miss Sharia Law, I call her, Linda Sarsour, one of the principal organizers of the women's protest rally back on January 21st, remember? Well, Linda Sarsour has a jaded background, which is problematical. How can she be a voice for women's rights when she's a Muslim woman and she wants to implicate Sharia law and institute it here across the United States? There is nothing in Islam that is compatible with the rights of women, but ignorantly, so many women follow after her. What I've decided to do is to feature a special little mini live report that you can share with many of your friends to get the message out about what the real agenda of Linda Sarsour is. I want you to hear it right now on the cross in the desert.
Assalamu alaikum, may peace be upon you, brothers and sisters.
Have you ever heard the name Linda Sarsour? If you don't know who this woman is, you should. Sarsour is a Palestinian-American activist and the executive director of the Arab American Association of New York. Sarsour is one of the women who organized the Women's March on Washington back in January. She's being championed as a beacon of light for women's rights and a new leader of the modern feminist movement. Sarsour has been endorsed by the likes of Amnesty International, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Black Lives Matter, Senator Bernie Sanders, Representative Keith Ellison, Van Jones, Sally Cohn, Susan Sarandon, Mark Ruffalo, Sean King, and Russell Simmons. But who is Linda Sarsour really? Some interesting facts and statements from and about her can be unearthed with some digging. As soon as Sarsour realized that she was going to be put forth as a leader of the modern feminist movement, she began deleting tweets that she had previously posted to Twitter. Here's a tweet that she sent out in 2011.
Sarsour has lashed out at other prominent women who are in favor of reforming some of the tenets of Islam.
Ms. Sarsour is hostile to me, not because she knows me, but because she's a fake feminist. Ms. Sarsour is not interested in universal human rights. She's a defender of Sharia law.
Besides the tweet being severely anti-woman, the one thing that people should take into account is who Sarsour is talking about. Ayan Hirsi Ali. Ali is the founder of the AHA Foundation. The foundation focuses on women's rights, and Ali actively campaigns against the very thing Sarsour said she wanted to do to Ali. Female genital mutilation. Sarsour may be a media professed champion of women's rights, but she also vehemently believes in the one system of law that gives women almost no rights. Sharia law.
We come to the U.S., 22 states with anti-Sharia bills trying to ban us from practicing our faith.
Sarsour has publicly supported Sharia law, which includes beliefs such as a man is entitled up to 4 wives, but a woman may only have 1 husband. Sexual submission is traditionally regarded as unconditional consent for the remainder of the marriage. There is no specific minimum age for marriage, but most agree a woman must have reached puberty. A woman becomes subservient to her husband and needs his permission to leave the house, take up employment, or to engage in fasting or forms of worship other than what is obligatory. A woman's testimony is worth only half that of a man's in court. Women who allege rape without the benefit of the act having been witnessed by 4 men are actually confessing to having sex. If a woman is married and then raped without 4 men witnessing the act, the woman is accused of adultery. Sarsour also doesn't think that Islam should be in any way, shape, or form associated with terrorism, as evidenced in this tweet. Despite her public opposition to the world's preeminent terror group, ISIS, the group could not be who they are without the word Islamic in it. According to the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies, 77% of terror attack plots in the United States were motivated by Islam. A 2015 study found that 99.5% of all suicide attacks worldwide were also motivated by Islam, as reported by Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies. It seems Sarsour's public tweets don't fall in line with someone that is supposed to be fighting for women's rights. One of the most alarming things that we found about Sarsour is that she will be speaking in April at an event in Chicago. The event is being hosted by an organization called Jewish Voice for Peace. The following is per Jewish Voice for Peace's mission statement. JVP seeks an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. It seems as though this particular Jewish group is actually against the State of Israel. That sounds like tolerance, but not nearly as tolerant as the other woman who will be speaking at the event with Sarsour. The woman in question is Ramzia O'Day. O'Day not only is calling internationally for women to strike on March 8th, but she also has direct ties to terrorism, namely that she herself is in fact a convicted terrorist. O'Day was convicted in 1970 of taking part in two bombings the year before. She was convicted for her role in a bombing of the British consulate, and was also convicted of taking part in a bombing in Israel that killed two students and injured nine others. It seems Sarsour is supporting a way of life that directly contradicts her being hailed as the feminist hero liberals have and will continue to make her out to be.
Well, and she's nothing more and nothing less but a fake feminist. She has pro-Palestinian coming from that background, and she's actually sharing the platform for someone that is completely against the Jewish state and believes the takeover of the Jewish state by the Palestinians. Not only that, but the book that Linda Sarsour quotes from, lives by, worships by, the Quran, gives the right for the husband of a wife to beat her if he suspects that she has been unfaithful. He doesn't have to find out that she has been, only if he suspects that she has been unfaithful, that the husband has the right to strike and beat his wife. So much for women's rights, right? There's nothing good about the teachings of Islam and the role of the woman. As you can hear in that special report, the husband is the god of the woman, and everything that he says she must do in so many ways. Because she can't travel abroad without his permission, she can't get a job or leave the house without his permission, she is under the total domination and control of the male figure of the household. This is the teachings of Islam and the Quran. Make no mistake about it. The facade that you get these days about Islam being peaceful and family-oriented is nothing more than a cover-up for the real goals of Islam against the woman. So how can so many American women be so willingly ignorant about a woman who was leading them astray? And that is the sad thing that goes on here. Here in America, women have many rights, and they have much freedom. Why would they want to trade the blessed freedom that they have here to be in the tentacles of Islam, which will enslave them? So I hope that this little special report will help many women who might be listening to this radio broadcast come to the realization that if they're going to be champions for women's rights, they need to find someone much different than Linda Sarsour to rally around. I want to also leave you with a special clip from some lady. I call her just the voice of truth. Her name is Tommy Lauren. She works with The Blaze, and final thoughts from Tommy Lauren is a special YouTube broadcast. I love this woman. She is so right on, and she articulates her points so rapidly and quickly in just 3 minutes. I want you to hear Tommy Lauren on what a real woman is as she talks about International Women's Day. Let's listen.
It's time for final thoughts. Happy International Women's Day. I'm here at work today because I'm a woman, not a victim. I didn't wake up this morning worrying about what protest color I'd wear or what the world would do without me because I didn't wake up feeling like the victimhood narrative was part of my story. I didn't wake up and tell myself I deserve special treatment because I have ovaries and a menstrual cycle. See, real women don't have to remind the world every single day that history once slighted us. Real women don't wake up and skip work to march for abortions or paid contraceptives, while women in less fortunate parts of the world wake up without basic human rights. Real women understand that true equality doesn't mean special treatment. To the young ladies wondering what it takes to be a real woman, this isn't it.
Yes, I have thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House. But I know that this won't change anything. I am a nasty woman.
If that's the feminist definition of inspiration and empowerment, count me out. And if Women's March organizer and executive director of the Arab American Association of New York, Linda Sarsour, is a leader of the movement, that says a lot about the spirit of the movement. I don't know about a day without women, but I could use a day without this nasty feminist BS masqueraded as women's rights. Seriously. Yeah, some challenges might be a little greater for women, but let me tell you, it feels a whole hell of a lot better to overcome those challenges than it does to dwell on them, complain about them, or use them as an excuse to fall short. If you constantly claim you're a victim, you will always be a victim. Free yourself. To the young ladies out there, you don't have to demand free things from taxpayers to be real women. You also don't have to skip work and shut down public schools to be real women. That's called real selfish. Now, I don't know about you, but I was raised by a real woman who went to work every day because guess what? Protesting doesn't pay the bills. You feminists can keep your race card, your victim card, your woman card, and your F Trump signs. I'll keep my dignity, my self-respect, my work ethic, and the values my mother and my father raised me with. And P.S., I'm a Republican, and I'll pay for my own birth control. Those are my final thoughts. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Tommy Lahren from Dallas. Happy International Women's Day, and take care.
Well, no one says it quite like Tommy Lahren. She has a way with words, doesn't she? But her points are absolutely right on target. Protesting doesn't pay the bills, and a real woman keeps her job and doesn't go out and act and behave like this. Fake feminism has done nothing but really destroy the true spirit of women's rights, and I hope they get a clue after listening to Tommy Lahren, don't you? Well, what I want to do right now on The Cross in the Desert, I want to introduce you to a new segment on my teaching. I've been teaching on the Beatitudes, the powerful life-transforming words of Christ. And we have been going through about 2 months of in-depth teaching on the Beatitudes. And we are now going to transition to that part of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus introduces as salt and light and how we can influence the world after teaching us the principles of kingdom living. So how do you and I become life-transforming citizens of the world, influencing it for the gospel? We're going to talk about that today on The Cross in the Desert. But before we do that, I want you to hear this powerful song from a Christian band I grew up listening to more than 30 years ago. This is Servant, and we are the light of the world right now on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
We are the light. We are the light. We
the powerful Christian music of Servant and We Are the Light. We are the light of the world. This is a familiar phrase I'm sure that you've heard said many times. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Today, I am continuing on the life-transforming words of Jesus from the Sermon on the Mount, which comprises chapters 5 through 7 in the Gospel according to Matthew. And this is very important because for the next few months, we are going to go through the entire Sermon on the Mount. We started with the Beatitudes, the first 11 verses, and now we are transitioning to that part of the teaching by Christ where he is helping us as kingdom citizens live out the principles that he has taught us. And he begins with this famous and well-known statement, quoted so often, of being salt and light. I want to read this text to you. I'm reading from the English Standard Version translation of the Bible. And so follow me in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. These are well-known, often quoted words of Jesus, but there is a lot here. And I want us to keep in mind something very important called context. For the last couple of months, I have shared with you in depth a beatitude every radio program. We have gone in depth about blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are they that mourn, and you remember all of this. But now we get to that section where Christ has finished talking about these eight beatitudes. And now it's as if he's looking us in the eyes and saying, you have to live what I taught you in such a way that your conduct, your mannerism is persuasive, it's preserving, it's attracting not to you, but attracting to my Father in heaven, that you live in such a way. You see, this is the part we sometimes miss. We hear the words of Christ. They're very powerful, convicting, and transforming. But now he's bridging the gap, if you will, and transitioning in his teaching, saying, now it's time to live the things that I've taught you. And so you are the salt of the earth is the first idiom that he uses. Notice that Jesus compares the disciples to salt. You are the salt of the earth. He's comparing us, kind of strange comparison, isn't it? What does it mean to be salt? Well, how was salt used in the days of Jesus? There were many uses for salt, and most of these uses are still the same today. Salt was used in the culture that Jesus taught as a preservative to prevent corruption, fertilizer. It was used to add flavor. And it was used to symbolize wisdom. So salt here is a preservative against corruption. It's used as fertilizer as well. And it adds flavor. It creates thirst, if you will. It was also an element used in sacrifices, a purifier, a condiment, a preservative. It had many symbolic associations, a sign of wisdom. Well, but careful here. It's not likely that Jesus is limiting his comparison of the disciples to salt to any one of these uses. He's not limiting it because there's so many uses to salt. It's really impossible to single anyone out. Well, if there's one word I want you to remember here, it's the word influence. Jesus is teaching his disciples as salt and light to influence the world, the society, around them. It's very important. We are to make an impact on the world. When it comes to the uses of salt, it affects what it comes in contact with, right? It affects meats by preserving them. It affects food by adding flavor. It affects ice by melting it, and so on. You are the salt of the earth. I'd like to say it this way. Salt creates a thirst. You want something to drink when you add salt to your food, or you add salt to a boiled egg and eat it. What does that mean for us as Christians? We want to create in unbelievers as salt, as a thirst for God, to create a thirst in the hearts and minds of unbelievers as salt. He wants us to act like salt here. Jesus compares his disciples to salt, saying that they are to make an impact on their world. But what does that look like? Here's the problem here. Jesus presents the problem. He says, if salt has lost its taste, how shall that saltiness be restored? It's like Jesus is asking a question, but also giving a warning, emphasizing the importance of salt keeping its taste. How do you lose your saltiness? Jesus asks. Well, it becomes diluted. When something becomes diluted, it loses its taste. Like, for instance, here I am a big fan of Crystal Light. I love it. It's very low calorie, not a lot of sugar at all, less than 1%. And I fill up the pitcher and I overflow it with too much water and then pour in the mix, and it tastes weak, diluted. It doesn't taste really good because I added way too much water. Well, in the same way, salt loses its flavor if it becomes diluted. Have you ever tried to separate salt when it's mixed with water? Jesus is saying it's impossible to restore saltiness or flavor once it's been diluted. And Jesus is saying we will lose our effectiveness and uselessness to the world if we become diluted with the philosophy of the world. So there's a prevalent theme in Scripture that basically teaches that it's impossible to associate or flirt with sin without harming yourself. Proverbs 6:27, can a man carry fire next to his chest and his clothes not be burned? Think about it. If you and I become diluted by sin, what makes us really different than anyone else? If we're just doing what everyone else is doing, how are we influencing others? So, in order for us to keep our saltiness and not lose our flavor and become useless to be trampled under by feet, if you will, is to not become contaminated and diluted with worldliness. Jesus says, it is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Well, this is a warning. Jesus says, when salt has lost its salt-like character, it has no longer any value. So this is a warning not to dilute oneself with the culture and the world's philosophy, not to be entangled with sin to the extent that you become no different than anyone else and you lose your attractiveness, you lose your effectiveness, you lose your saltiness. Luke chapter 14, verse 34 through 35 says almost the same thing. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Wow. So Jesus is saying here that if you've lost your influence, if the church has become so diluted that there's no difference between the church and the world, you're not even worthy to be among the manure pile. He's not saying here that we lose our salvation, but what Jesus is saying, we lose our effectiveness to really accomplishing the mission that we as Christians have in this culture. With great responsibility, John MacArthur writes, there is often great danger. We cannot be an influence for purity in the world if we have compromised our own purity. We cannot sting the world's conscience if we continually go against our own. We cannot stimulate thirst for righteousness if we have lost our own. We cannot be used of God to retard the corruption of sin in the world if our own lives become corrupted by sin. To lose our saltiness, John MacArthur writes, is not to lose our salvation, but it is to lose our effectiveness and to become disqualified for service. So summing up what Jesus is teaching about us being salt, we are to make an impact on the world, because if we don't, we're pretty useless. And so the question is, are you making an impact in your culture, on your world? Or are you allowing yourself to be diluted by the sins of the world? The world needs our impact, not our compromise. Jesus also, within that same teaching, comes up with another metaphor for Christians, from salt to light. Jesus says, you are the light of the world. Well, it's very simple what Jesus is teaching here. Light is one of the scripture's most common symbols. God is light, 1 John 1:5. Christ is light, John 8:12. God's people are light, Ephesians 5:8, 1 Thessalonians 5:5. Now think about this with me. What are some uses for light? Well, it's the chief function to make one the ability of one to see. Jesus says we are the salt of. What does he say we are the light of? We are the light of the world. That is because we are that window through which God's light enters the world. He chose us to do this very thing. Paul says concerning our conversion, that God has shown his light in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6. God didn't give us the gospel to be a hidden secret, but so that the whole world can see his light and transformation in us. I'm really stunned by some Christians that say, well, you know, I keep this kind of personal. I don't want to offend anyone, so I don't really talk about this with other people. Well, folks, you've missed it completely, and I question whether you're a Christian or not, because Jesus is very clear that we are to shine this light to the whole world. And he makes the comparison, the next statement, a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. You can't imagine that, can you? The picture Jesus is painting is of houses and buildings that stand on a landscape shining brilliantly during the night. And the point he is trying to make is this, what he wants to say. If you're truly a Christian, it's hard to hide it. If you're truly loving God and growing in your passion for him, people are going to notice. You're going to be like a city set on a hill. Can you really hide a city setting on a hill? Well, neither can you hide the gospel's transformation in you if you truly have that transformation. And Jesus finally concludes his short teaching here about our impact to the world by saying, hiding our light, that's impossible. He says, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. Candles are put on holders to increase their range of light. And, you know, decades ago, when light was first being invented, or discovered, if you will, a man would come around your street and light oil lamps in the streets. He would get on a ladder because the pole was so tall. Ceiling fans are also on the ceiling for a purpose. The lamp here that Jesus is talking about was probably a small oil-burning portable with a wick. And, you know, think about it. It would be extremely foolish to light it and then hide it under a bowl. What do you do to make your light shine? You don't be quiet. You don't become politically correct. You don't become ashamed and afraid. When you know that someone needs to hear the gospel, or when you know that God's word must be defended in the marketplace, but you say nothing, you're hiding your light. You can hide your light by going along with the crowd, but how are you shining God's light if you're doing what everyone else is doing? God qualifies us. Jesus qualifies the reason we shine our light. Our motivation is not to bring attention to ourselves, but the reason we shine our light and let our salt attract the thirst of people, the reason we do this is to glorify God, never ourselves. Jesus says the purpose for shining our light is so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. You don't engage in good works so that people can look at us, but you do it to draw attention to God the Father. In other words, we shine by becoming invisible. Even everything we do is to be for the glory of God. So whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God, Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 10:31. We make an impact by our deeds to draw attention to God. I want to share with you the story of a young Buddhist student. This young Buddhist student made a very serious, careful study of Christianity, the scriptures, the person of Jesus. He even talked to a Christian about his studies, and he said this to the Christian he was sharing with. The Buddhist said, "You know, your Christ is wonderful. Oh, so wonderful. But you Christians, you're not like him." Without knowing it, that Buddhist pointed out the greatest need of present-day Christianity, and that is we need to be more Christ-like. We need to bear the salt and light that Jesus is talking about here. So my admonition to you as Christians, let us be salt and light for God's glory. That's the kind of kingdom people that God wants to make an impact, you and me. But then there are those of you that have listened maybe in the last several months to the teachings about Christ, and you're attracted to the authority and the meaning of his words, but you don't know him. You only have a head knowledge of who he is. Jesus says, "Come to me, you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." He invites you to know him personally. It is one thing to know about the President of the United States. It's quite another thing to go to the White House and shake his hand and get to know him personally. You can study all about him in the textbooks. You can listen to his speeches on TV and radio and the internet, but it's a whole different situation once you walk up to him and you see him face to face and he stretches out his hand to shake yours. Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone answers and lets me in, I will come in and dine and sup with them." Christianity is a love relationship with God through Christ. It is not enough to study and to know about Jesus. It is to come to Christ because we are broken over sin. Because we are hopeless, we are desperate. We have no peace, we have no hope in our life. We are completely at the mercy of God. This was much like my Iranian friend Maral, who when she traveled across the globe, she hung on to two verses I shared with her from Jeremiah 29:11, but particularly what Jesus said, "Knock and the door will be open. Seek and you shall find. Ask and it will be given to you. Those words from the Sermon on the Mount stuck with Maral, and she held on to hope to those words the day she gave her heart to Jesus. I invite you today to know Jesus, to know him as Lord and Savior, to find hope, purpose, and forgiveness in him and him alone. I want to thank you so much, Patricia, and all who join me today in the chat room. The next live broadcast will be on Nowruz next Monday, a special broadcast for my Iranian friends. God bless you. Have a great week, and I will see you next Monday on the Cross in the Desert. Goodbye.
Great of rap.